rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Podcast tax bombshell. Strike up the band. Are you the bad people?
Eating chicken goujons and drinking warm white wine? No.
Policy, Polly.
PM for PM.
But I'm just going to go off and have a nice plate of goujon somewhere. I'm sorry.
Yes, here we are again, all reunited in the studio. This is How to Win an Election. I'm Matt Shawley with Daniel Finstein, Polly McKenzie and Peter Manderson. How are we all?
Well, we're quite well. Except that in your programme...
Have you appointed him spokesperson?
In your programme last week
yes.
About political nicknames, you overlooked mine, which is quite well known.
The big cuddly bear of the Labour Party?
Yeah. Prince of Darkness.
Prince of Darkness. But you don't like it, do you?
I don't like it.
Well, that's why I didn't bring it up.
I don't like it. I've left all the dark arts behind me, and in any case, I'm now the Dark Lord, not the Prince of Darkness. But it's just nice not to be overlooked.
But also, Matt, when you asked how we all were, how did you expect me to answer that question? I mean, did you think I'd gone round...
I expected you all individually to say, fine, thanks very much, let's get on with the program.
That wouldn't be going to answer your question, then. That would be, how am I?
How are you, Dan?
I'm fine, thank you.
How is each of you?
But I don't know how either.
How is each of you?
How are you, Polly?
I'm
fine. I had a really good coffee this morning from the lovely baristas on this floor.
Yeah.
Normally, I don't want to queue because it's a really long queue here.
Well, why should you?
I did. Queuing.
Woman of your stature.
5 foot 4.
Have you got any nicknames, Polly? Apart from Policy McKenzie, obviously.
My sister sometimes calls me Poddle.
Right.
Yeah, that's about it, though.
Danny, any nicknames?
No, just Fink. For the people to use that, yeah.
Fink.
The last editor of the paper was used to say... Fink. He used to go, Fink, you like everyone. That's your problem.
It's great. I mean, it's not the best chat we've ever had, but it's fine. Anyway, thanks for kicking
off. We're just trying to move on from Polly's coffee queue.
If you want to get in touch with similar levels of top quality political insight, you can email us howtowin@thetimes.co.uk or you can WhatsApp us a voice note, 0333 003 2353. On the subject of which, we've had this question from Jeff.
I would like to ask your distinguished panellists, if you really had to, could you identify a plausible scenario where Rishi Sunak and the Tories were able to deny Labour an overall majority at the next election? Because the chances of that happening may be very small, but they're not zero.
Yeah, if your life depended on it, could you come up with a thing that Rishi Sunak could do?
God. I mean...
It all depends on the word. It hangs on the word plausible, doesn't it? Because, you know, What would destroy the Labour Party's fortunes? I don't know, something to do with Keir Starmer and a donkey, or who knows? Something could happen. Is it plausible? I think at this stage, I really racked my brains on this.
I think there would be some terrible donkey or other related scandal to afflict the Labour Party and probably the Liberal Democrats as well. The SNP would have to have some miraculous renaissance in Scotland. Interest rates would have to plummet and everyone would feel better off. But I'm not even sure that that would be enough for Rishi Sunak. I think Britain would have to sweep the gold medal tables in the Paris Olympics euphoria to take over the country.
Danny's itching to tell us the medal table
won't make any difference.
No, because people don't think that that's obviously the government's doing, so that wouldn't change anything. But I guess the only thing you could think plausibly is that the question sharply changes at the next general election because of something that we don't know is going to happen. So, for instance, we ended up in the middle of a pandemic. That could have happened, I suppose, coinciding with the general election rather than shortly after it. So, war with Iran is an example. It would have to be something, by the way, that the Labour Party would struggle with or that wouldn't produce an immediate coming together of the parties, and possibly as it did in the 1930s, then a delay in the elections. So what we're proving here is just how strong the chances are of Labour winning. If you looked at factors that were a bit more likely than some major thing, I suppose the collapse of the Reform Party, which is actually a bit of a rickety structure, even though it's got quite a lot of support, that would obviously help the Conservative Party and it would also produce more momentum. And at the same time, the Labour Party splitting in some way over some issue, possibly foreign policy related. Gaza is still an issue on which the Labour Party is struggling with some of its activists, for example. I just think those are small in likelihood. They're not absolutely implausible. But they're small in
likelihood. What this discussion is confirming is that the Labour Party must absolutely think the entire time that the Conservatives could come back. That is the only way to run a disciplined election campaign. It could happen, and therefore the Labour Party has to be absolute peak perfection in its campaign.
We also need to remember that the Conservatives basically need to win a majority to stay in government, whereas the Labour Party might be able to stitch together a minority government or a coalition government of some kind. A lot of this hangs on what happens with the SNP, but the SNP have said very clearly they would not prop up a minority Conservative government. Change leader, maybe they'll change their minds on that, but that'd be incredibly difficult for them. And that's what makes the hurdle even higher for Rishi Sunak. It's not enough to deny Labour a majority. They actually still need to have a majority of their own.
A bit more plausible is that the Labour Party doesn't actually win a majority. Right now, at the moment, it looks like it will win a majority, but when you look at that historically, that is a very large thing to do because it requires a huge swing. And it's possible that by the time we get to the general election, natural factors, for example, the somewhat of an improvement in the economy and the fact that people are not wildly enthusiastic about Keir Starmer might erode what some of the less exuberant polls suggest. I think I have long believed Labour would win a majority, and I retain that belief, but that wasn't the question.
Yeah.
But just bear in mind that even if Labour now gets a new Labour swing of Blair proportions, circa 1997... it still only gets a majority of one this time because we're starting from so far behind.
But what's really interesting, basically what we've proved is that almost everything that might help Rishi Sunak are not actually things within Rishi Sunak's own gift, control. It's all massive external forces rather than...
Yeah, the narrative telling is, though, so I think what we've discussed before is that he could try to shape improvement in the economy behind a narrative. I suggested last week in my column in the Times that it would be about turning the corner. which is about the only thing. She's about as much of Britain's on the right track as people are willing to accept, because they don't think Britain is on the right track, but they might be willing to accept Britain's turning the corner. And if he could shape it in the right way, he could help himself somewhat.
But the danger is, though, if Britain has turned the corner, then we can have those nice guys all fix the NHS back. If as people sort of wanted in 97, a sense that the economy had turned around.
I think Polly's right. I mean, my riposte to turning the corner would be actually the public want to turn the page. They want to start a new chapter.
Yes, but we're discussing what might help.
He's been reading
Prince of Metaphors.
Although Keir Starmer, I'm just trying to look, because his
what's he saying?
Well, no, his statement in response to Dan Poulter's defection was, I thought, a bit gobbledygook. It's time to end the Conservative chaos, turn the page and get Britain's future back.
Okay.
So there were too many metaphors.
Here's the problem with turning the page. Can I ask this?
No, he says that because he's
turn the page
to
go back.
No, because he listens to the podcast.
Okay.
He's picked up all this.
Okay, can I... As we've now got his attention, Peter, let me just ask you a bit more about that turning the page. So the problem Labour's got is that people don't probably correctly think that the Labour would turn the page, right? So they probably correct... I mean, I think Keir Starmer's slogan is, it's, you know, everything in this country is broken, let's make sure we do absolutely nothing about it. That's what he's offering. And people find that quite reassuring. At the same time as finding things the country is broken. So there are contradictory attitudes. The problem with turning the page, as opposed to something a little bit less ambitious like turning the corner, is that I think people are pretty sceptical that any politician, and Labour included, constitutes a turning of the page.
I think people do feel sort of dismally about the state of the country, and they are jaundiced or slightly cynical about any politician's or party's ability to make a real difference. I accept that completely, but that doesn't nonetheless mean that, you know, all you do as a Labour Party is promise more of the same. You have to offer hope. You have to offer change. I mean, that's what people want. What you also have to make sure of is that you're not sort of planting a seed in people's minds that in turning the page, you might be going back to a previous chapter.
one of those make your own adventure books.
I mean, that's
if you
the
want
problem.
To, if you'd
always
like Tony Blair back, go to page 16.
that's been the problem for the Labour Party in the past. I don't think it's a problem now, but it has been a problem in the past, and that's what makes people fearful sometimes of a Labour government.
I think they're also worried, aren't they, Peter, about over-promising and under-delivering. Because they are thinking about, you know, more than one term.
There's not much chance of that with the current Labour leadership.
But it's interesting. I've heard...
I mean, they're not over-promising. You can hardly say that.
No, but exactly. They're so frightened of doing that. They're like, let's under-promise and then possibly deliver some of what we've promised.
I think that's just about right.
I work at a university. We're really worried across the higher education sector about financial difficulties. And the government is moving forward on changes to graduate fees, which could have huge impacts on like university sort of financial difficulties, even bankruptcies. And what we've heard is government saying, well, it doesn't matter because it'll only sort of crystallise during a first Labour term. And you do hear some of the more kind of hyper-political actors in the Conservative Party talking about this idea that actually just making the economy as bad as possible or the situation with public services as bad as possible will mean that the Labour Party will fail. And therefore the Conservatives can win again after one term. I don't think politics ever actually plays out like that. It's just too complicated. But I think there is a sense that they want to pass a kind of really toxic and difficult inheritance onto the Labour Party.
I think that's right. And by the way, on the subject of universities, I've just joined a commission on the future of universities. If we do not get our universities right, if we don't repair their finances, we're never going to be able to create sustained growth in this country again. Our future prosperity in this country is going to be built on the shoulders of our great research-based universities, and we better learn that and address it properly.
Yeah. And it's arts-based universities as well.
It's not the objective of the government to make life difficult in the Labour Party.
On that point, though, the other thing is that once you are in government, your ability, as the coalition showed, your ability to shape the narrative of, oh, it's much worse here than we thought, and actually then therefore blame your predecessors for the mess that they left, rather than, you know, even if they did pull off leaving some terrible inheritance. Well, you know, George Osborne, David Cameron and Nick Clegg spent 5 years saying it was all Labour's fault.
I mean, what's weird is when the Conservative Party still tries to pull that trick off. you've been in power for 14 years, mate. Yeah. Like, it's definitely not Alistair Darling's fault, right, at this point.
Okay, on the subject, we were talking about, you mentioned it, everyone in the Labour Party is listening to the podcast, Peter. Has Graham Brady been listening, in particular to you? The Telegraph have got this recording of him speaking to university students.
I would, from choice, I would remove that final vote for the members when the party is in government. Problem is, this has never happened.
A high quality recording there.
it is the Daily Telegraph.
What he was saying was, Graham Brady, chairman of the 1922 committee, he would remove the vote from party members for choosing the leader when they're in government, which is precisely what we were talking about last week. You think that, and actually, lots of people then on the social media said this was very undemocratic, taking things away from the membership.
Yeah, they say that, but in my view, they're wrong, because the great Tony Benn argument in favour of extending the franchise to party members and union activists was that we're extending democracy. We weren't extending it; we were narrowing it to the base of the party. Who were able to follow their own sort of prejudices and predilections, regardless of the views of the public, whose support we need to get into government. So it wasn't a broadening, it was a narrowing.
You can basically pay for a vote. That's the system.
Yeah, it's cheap.
So it seems to me extraordinary that people haven't reached the sort of logical conclusion that one of the most influential things that you can do is join a political party, particularly one that you don't agree with, and help to choose the leader. Yeah. The choice of the of Liz Truss over Rishi Sunak by Conservative members at the when they made that choice does not accord to any democratic principle. People paid for a vote. They were a vast number of demographically completely unrepresentative people, and they chose somebody who, you know, the rest of the country wouldn't have chosen.
But this is how we got Jeremy Corbyn. But the reason we got Jeremy Corbyn is because Ed Miliband who had introduced these changes, you know, to pay tuppence halfpenny to get a vote in the leadership. Then when he lost in 2015, Harriet Harman, the acting leader, said, right, let's throw open all the doors and the windows, everyone can pay their tuppence halfpenny and come and vote for the name. Well, of course they did, and they flocked in. Yeah. And that's how we got Jeremy.
I think total unity here, right? Like, us and Graham Brady, don't let the party members have the vote. It's a distorted view of what democracy is. It's an internal democracy within the party, which, and also the more reliant you are on your party members for donations as well, the more it becomes totally self-reinforcing. And so you get audience capture. Yeah. And that distorts the ability of a party to represent who it needs to represent, which is ideally the whole country, but at the very least, all of the people who are voting for you. Yeah. It's one of the most fundamental kind of changes we need to make in our
cozy consensus has broken out.
But by the way, the point about this is that I'm a Conservative, right, with both a big C and a small C, and I believe in parliamentary democracy, and this is a mechanism that undermines parliamentary democracy, and you end up with leaders of the parliamentary party who are not supported by the members of parliament, which produces a completely impossible tension. And this is not a speculative thing. It's happened repeatedly. It happened with Ian Duncan Smith. It happened with Liz Truss. It happened with Jeremy Corbyn. Yeah. Right? And so therefore, it's,
you could strike a compromise. You could say, right, members of the party nominate, but members of parliament choose finally and vote. It's a compromise. Could do that.
You could have them involved in the earlier stage rather than the later one.
Yeah, you reverse it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there we are. Well, I'm glad we've all agreed on that. Up next, the role of Scotland and Scottish politics in helping to choose who the Prime Minister is, and what impact will the SNP shenanigans have on Keir Starmer's ability to become Prime Minister? We'll do that next on How to Win an Election.
one size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
In a very timely fashion, we've had this question from Braden.
Hi, Matt, Danny, Peter and Polly. Big fan of the podcast and particularly the theme tune. Now we're seeing the SNP in trouble with, you know, Hamza Youssef resigning. And that despite the events down south, we're seeing Conservatives, Labour and the Liberal Democrats all looking at gains in Scotland. So what are the panel's thoughts on Scotland's role in winning an election and what impact will Scottish voters have on the different parties? Thanks.
A question from Braden there. Now, for the first time on the podcast, we've got a special guest. Ooh! Lindsay McIntosh is now the head of news at the Sunday Times, but has covered Scottish politics off and on for 20 years, previously Scottish political at the Times, and is joining us live from Aberdeen. Hello, Lindsay.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
I'm very well. What's the weather like?
It's beautiful. It's really sunny. The fresh air is lovely. And the government's sort of on the verge of collapse. But other than that, it's great.
So how bad are things looking for the SNP from there?
Pretty, pretty grim, to be honest. I mean, the podcast is called How to Win an Election. The SNP has been an election-winning machine for, you know, nearly two decades. They've done what they've done better than anybody else. They've had incredible party discipline over the years. They've had two, whatever you think of their politics, fantastic, arguably, at stages, leaders in Salmond and Sturgeon. And now, essentially, the wheels are coming off. And last night, the ballots opened for what is possibly going to be an incredibly bitter and divisive election contest. You've got the possibility that you'll have John Swinney standing to be leader. And, you know, John Swinney is a smart man. He's a kind man. He's incredibly, you know, hardworking. But he was also leader between the year 2000 and 2004, you know?
And had to be removed because they weren't doing very well.
Exactly. You know, he was preceded by Salmond and he was succeeded by Salmond. And I think, you know, as I say, great, many strengths. But if the answer to the question is John Swinney, are, you know, what is the question?
Wow. Peter, given Labour's dominance, most of the time you were in government, Labour dominated Scotland. How did you lose Scotland to the SNP?
We lost Scotland by becoming less relevant in the sense that what Scots wanted was more Scottishness, a greater expression of Scottish identity, national identity, which I think was reasonable, which they felt they wanted to get more of by going beyond devolution. But more importantly, in my view, because they wanted a Tory-free Scotland. and they didn't think that Labour was going to offer a Tory-free Scotland. They thought the best way to free Scotland from the Tories was by becoming completely independent. And that's what put the turbocharge into the nationalist movement, the independence movement. Now, what's changed is that the Labour Party has now risen up in England, and it's perfectly clear to everyone in Scotland that there is no legal route to a second independence referendum. That's not going to happen. That horse has bolted. The door is now closed or whatever. That the only way to get a Tory-free Scotland is by replacing the Tory government in Westminster with a Labour one. And the prospect of that is now very strong because of the party's polling in the rest of the United Kingdom. Having said that, I do think the Labour Party has got to work out an effective campaign which recruits former SNP voters who retain a sort of nationalistic outlook. I think that Labour is not going to recruit those voters by talking about independence, and it's most certainly not. I do think, though, that it's got to combine a sense of Scottish identity with people's Britishness. Now, there's a nuance in that. So Labour has got to be taught, Labour in Scotland has got to present a profile of Scottishness, not separateness. It's got to, above all, though, put together a policy programme that's going to deliver for what is most important for people, which is, you know, jobs and economic growth and schools and healthcare and whatever. I think that in Scotland they have a really capable and likeable leader in Anna Sawa, and I think they now need a policy programme to match it.
And Scotland used to be a big stronghold of the Lib Dems as well, Polly. So what went wrong for the Lib Dems in Scotland?
I mean, going into government with the Conservatives, primarily. And the fundamental thing that a nationalist party can do is hold people together across an enormous political divide. Because we saw this with Brexit, right? If at the core of what you're saying is we ought to be able to make our own decisions about how to run our country, well, then actually, that's a great principled stance that people who think those decisions should be more left-wing can get behind, and people who think those decisions should be more right-wing can get behind. It's then very hard to deliver on that in government. And what I think has sort of hollowed the SNP out is they held on to that story of by blaming the Westminster government. And they did that very successfully under Salmond, under Sturgeon. Having somebody to blame in London for every single thing that is wrong with your country. And that is heartbreaking because that is the opposite of what devolution is supposed to do. It's supposed to give agency and power and authority to a place. And it holds nationalism behind the waterline.
It gave the SNP a hiding place.
And it is horrifying to look at, life expectancy and the gap in life expectancy between rich and poor, to look at universities, incredible universities, falling behind, to look at schools falling behind, to look at deaths of despair, drug death, addiction, homelessness. In Scotland, all things which are absolutely devolved, on which the SNP is able to just sort of say, oh, well, it's somebody else's fault. And I think unless you've got a phenomenal leader, a phenomenal politician, eventually people get a bit sick of that, really. And I think that is what Humza Yousaf has been unable to do, is, again, hold together a very progressive set of people and a very much, you know, I mean, Kate Forbes said that David Cameron was her political hero, sort of reasonable thing to believe, but quite hard to be in a party who also in allegiance with the Greens, and he just couldn't hold them together anymore.
So I think the key word you used there is eventually, because people have said, people have been saying for ages, the SNP is defying the laws of political gravity. And I used to listen to that and think, well, there's a reason why they call gravity a law. You can't defy it. And what we're
saying... Idina Menzel would disagree.
The most important thing we're seeing is the sort of the ordinary laws of how politics work assert themselves. The SNP have been in power for a long time, and eventually parties that have been in power a long time lose power. So you talk about the Tory free Scotland, but obviously, Scotland Tory free, but obviously at the 2017 election, the aim was to make Scotland Labour free. So I think the first sort of law that's asserting itself is one that the SNP haven't got much control over. The other law that's asserting itself is that if you move steadily towards the left in a sort of more and more outre progressive coalitions, eventually you lose your base. As Polly correctly points out, the SNP, like any political party, in order to be a big mass organisation, relies on a lot of not very ideological, quite practical people, often with fairly conservative attitudes who aren't paying much attention, with small c conservative attitudes, who aren't paying much attention to the political game. And to those people, the SNP was offering more and more and more left-wing agenda. And ultimately, you would think if you keep travelling away from the centre of gravity of voters, you're going to lose them. So, admittedly, Hamza Yousef's decision to part company with the Green Party when he didn't have a majority was an astonishing defiance of Lyndon Johnson's rule that in politics you need to learn how to count. I couldn't believe that he did that. But I don't actually think the root of it is really him. The root of it is they've been in power a long time and they're trying to move their party too far to the left, which I think started was Nicola Sturgeon's idea and ultimately was going to put them in this position.
But that's why he did.
But let's bring in Lindsay again. Lindsay, just having listened to that conversation, do you agree with that? Was Nicola Sturgeon moving to the left in part an attempt to try and see off the threat of a resurgent Labour Party?
I would certainly agree that the SNP has hung together a very diffuse and diverse coalition quite successfully for a long time. But the reason they've managed to do that is because all of those people believe in one goal, which is independence, right? So if you look at the policy platform that the SNP has proffered over the years, we had a kind of tartan Tories scenario a few decades ago. We had Alex Salmond, who was talking about sort of low-level taxation, but a Scandi public spending platform. And then we had Nicola Sturgeon, who did take the party socially to the left and economically to the left as well. Now, those are incredibly diverse manifestos, and yet they retained their membership, they increased their membership, and they retained their electoral ability, and because the one thing that they promised over everything was independence, and everything was subservient to that. And if you get to the point now where, irrespective of what Hamza Yousef said in that speech yesterday, where he claimed that they were in the last few miles of a marathon towards independence, independence actually looks much further away than it has done for a long, long time. And when that goal that's holding your party together starts to look unobtainable, certainly in the interim, then that party starts to fracture and fall apart.
They also, Lindsay, and you know this better than anybody, I mean, to deal with them up close in Hollywood as well, they had the sort of iron discipline over who... There was no divergence from the central line. The sort of iron discipline that makes Peter Manners and Alistair Campbell look like a pussycat by comparison. And that started crumbling as well, in part because they had a proper full-blown leadership election last year, which meant that people said different things and all of these slight differences all blew out into the open. But they kept that together for such a long time.
Yeah, they did, because they had this overarching aim of independence. And I think part of the reason for the problems that they find themselves in now is there hasn't really been, with some exceptions, a kind of training ground and breeding ground for talent to come through and rise to the top of the party. You know, when you had Nicola Sturgeon and Alex Salmond making that deal in 2004, where he would become leader and she would become deputy, that was such a clear chain of succession. Obviously, the whole thing fell apart in later years, but it did get them into power a number of times. And we don't really have that now. And, you know, maybe there is an argument that John Swinney will do some kind of deal with Kate Forbes and it'll all be sewn up and we won't get that bitter leadership contest that we had some 13 months ago. But if that doesn't happen and there is another leadership contest, I think it will be even more fragmenting than the previous one and do more harm to the party.
I think Lindsay is describing a patchwork quilt of a party, which is all coming apart at the seams. It was independence that supplied the thread that kept this patchwork quilt together. And in effect, what's happened is that the SNP has become structurally irrelevant. Irrelevant because its offer, it's a one-trick pony. The entire thing revolves around offering and getting independence. If that is no longer available, then it isn't, because there's no route via either the Conservatives or the Labour Party to a second referendum, let alone a successful one. That's the end of that. Which why, in a sense, it makes those in the... some in the Labour Party in Scotland who think that, you know, the Scottish electorate is completely different from the rest of the electorate in the, throughout across the UK, that there has to be a sort of completely different sort of framing of Labour's offer. Well, I think there's a bit of truth, but I think it's exaggerated, it's overinterpreted, and I think it leads you into a vote-losing area, because it leads you to offering, if you adopt that view, a sort of slimline, semi-skimmed version of the full fat version that the SNP are offering. And I don't think that's where the Labour Party should go. It has instead got to offer really strong policies on the things that matter to people. But here's the point. If Scottish Labour is going to do its bit in delivering a majority for the UK Labour Party so that we get a Labour government in Westminster and Whitehall, then that UK Labour government has got to deliver for Scotland. It's got to reciprocate, because that's the only way in which Scottish Labour is going to win the Holyrood parliamentary elections in 2026.
So they and then end up as the baddies the SNP can point at.
Danny, to what extent do you think that the, as we've seen with the Conservatives, I mean, the SNP now having sort of revelled in the awkwardness of the Conservatives, now find themselves in exactly the same place, three leaders in as many years. The mere act of changing leader, regardless of the circumstances and regardless of who follows, well, you know, reduces their reputation as being a serious political party.
It can. Obviously, it's also a moment where they can draw the line. If they can identify the things that make them look like they're continuity when people want change, then they can use it as a positive moment. If they've got somebody, it doesn't sound to me, and I'm not the expert on this, but just judging from what Lindsay's already said, it doesn't sound to me as though they have got that person. So clearly, if you appoint somebody and they have to resign after 15 months or little more than a month, you're not showing a great ability at choosing leaders, and you're also demonstrating the political problems you've got in the party, so it will damage you. But we've all three of us addressed this issue with Rishi Sunak. It is also a reset moment. You can use it in that way. It's hard when you've been in power a long time. So, you know, generally speaking, given what they've got in front of them, given the fact that they're unlikely to use that reset moment, given all the reasons that led him to resign, I think it will be a problem for them, yes.
What do you think, Lindsay? I mean, not least because if you're not in the SNP gang, the sense of schadenfreude from a political opponents, that having carried on holier than now, more disciplined than anyone else, better at COVID, better at this, better than that. And actually, it turns out they're a normal political party, and in Humza Yousaf's case last week, perfectly capable of making massive cock-ups.
Yeah, very true. I think that if they did go for John Swinney and get him in, he is the ultimate continuity candidate, and I think he would stabilise the ship, and I think he'd look like a grown-up and a professional in doing it. But the problem that they have is they've got an imminent general election, obviously, possibly as soon as the summer, and then they've got a Holyrood election in 2026. So there's this real kind of electoral... we're on an electoral footing, basically. And you need a bit of inspiration then. You know, the reason that the Nats were so good, one of the reasons they were so good for so long, is because they provided that kind of hopey, changey message. I mean, they didn't deliver in the end, those two things, I would argue, when they came up against reality, like any political party does in the end. But I don't see where that's coming from at the moment.
And it's completely extraordinary. So there's a YouGov poll that was carried out over the weekend, so post the ending of the deal with the Greens, but pre him actually resigning, puts Labour at 1 point ahead of the SNP in Scotland, 34%, which would give Labour 28 seats, the SNP 18, the Tories 6, and the Lib Dems 8. So everyone sort of picks up as a result. Polly, the impact of this row, fast, whatever you want to call it, on the green agenda?
So one of the key decisions that looks like it was a big mistake for the SNP was to commit to 75% reduction in carbon emissions by 2030, which the UK Climate Change Committee basically said, that's not going to work. I mean, they said it with more footnotes than that. But and it's been interesting because that's been picked up as a sort of proof that you shouldn't go too far and too fast on climate change, a bit like we saw in Uxbridge with the ULEZ, and this idea that this is once again demonstrates that green stuff is a turnoff for the voters. I think that's really profoundly not true. In fact, what Hamza Yousaf has dropped, leading to the rift with the Greens, but is that 75% commitment and come back down to 70%, which is what the Climate Change Committee recommended. This is why you have experts, in fact, to support democratic politicians to make good decisions. By contrast, what we've seen in England is Rishi Sunak pulling away from what the Climate Change Committee has recommended to say, let's go slower, let's do a bit less. Actually, I think there's a real risk, actually, that that climate change denier type politicians at the UK level are going to use this rift with the Greens as an excuse for pulling us away from sensible climate change policy.
I think you've got to pursue these goals realistically, but I think it would be absolutely wrong to abandon these targets and the policies now. And I say that partly because we've got to take climate action, but also because this transition, this energy transition, is happening. It's going to happen anyway. The question is, are we going to keep up with the rest of the world? But also, are we going to regear our economy in a way that enables us to supply this energy transition, to build out new businesses and industries and new markets and create jobs and a future basis for Britain's prosperity? That's one of the reasons I think it is so important for us to stick with the plan. But you do need a plan. And what the SNP didn't have, they had goals, but no plan.
No plan. Just finally then, because Lindsay, you mentioned the possibility of a summer election. I'll ask you all when you think the election is going to be, after the widespread speculation that Rishi Sunak might have called an election this week. I mean, he still could. Lindsay, when do you think the election is going to be?
I think November.
Danny?
Yeah, November.
Peter?
I'm a pre-Trump man, so I think no, October.
Polly?
Not July.
Still January?
I can't, in the end, see him calling it until the last minute because, you know, he's also got all of these constituency MPs who don't really want to be unemployed. I mean, that's why July just won't happen. Nobody wants to be unemployed with 6 weeks' notice.
Isn't Scotland, broadly speaking, on holiday in July and therefore it'd be a difficult time to have a general election in Scotland?
But everyone's on holiday at Christmas, so...
All true. Well, maybe, but then, you know, he's got to try and line
up. That's why January was never going to happen,
Polly. Christmas is a good time to get your hands on a donkey, though. You know, you could just, you know, raid a nativity.
Oh, no.
Maybe that's what we'll do. I mean, Lindsay McIntosh, thank you for joining us on the podcast. Bye-bye. Lindsay McIntosh there from the Sunday Times. Daniel Finkelstein, Polly McKenzie, Peter Madison. I was Matt Chully, and that was How to Win an Election.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.